Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. My name is Bill Wirtz, and as always, it is Billy Joel's Pressure Fading Out in the background. This is the episode of August 26, 2021. I'm currently on holidays. I'm on a trip around the Czech Republic, Poland, and France. And so I'm currently not at work, but I still wanted to get you an episode anyway. So a bit of a different episode this time. I'll be playing you an interview that is already available on the Consumer Choice Center YouTube page, but also previously played at my colleagues at Consumer Choice Radio. It's an interview I did with Dr. Kathleen Heffron. She's Canadian, and she used to be the research director at the Department of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell University, and she's now a lecturer at the University of Toronto in the Department of Cell Biology and Genetics. She is very knowledgeable on innovation agriculture and crop protection, but also lately has been publishing on the issue of plant-based vaccines and also the issue of vaccines in plants. So very interesting interview that we did in the past, and I wanted to play for you. So take it away, and I think by the time of the next episode, I'll be back with the regular scheduled program. So Kathleen, thank you so much for taking the time. And thank you for being with us today.
Oh, not at all. Thank you very much.
So we want to talk about food, of course, the consumer issue number one. We all eat it every day. So, and one disparity that I've noticed covering agriculture for the Consumer Choice Center is that a lot of consumers sometimes have a lot of opinions about food, and some of them are activists in that range, but not necessarily, they don't have necessarily all the information about it. So let's start a bit at the beginning. Let's go through what problems do farmers actually run into. So when a farmer works on food trying to grow it, what sort of problems is he and she confronted with when it comes to pests and diseases and the like?
Well, that's a great and, you know, highly complex question, which, you know, I think someone who's an expert in the field could talk for hours and hours about. But I think that you can really narrow it down to a number of different pests that are issues for farmers. Insects, pests are a big one that we hear about all the time. We've been hearing recently about the locusts in East Africa. So that's an example, or fall armyworm, which is, I don't think it's so prominent in Europe, but it's certainly in the US, and now it's moving on to Africa, I believe. Diamondback moth is another one that we hear about. So insects are a big one. Bacteria. We have bacteria which infect plants, and it's difficult for farmers to deal with that kind of situation. Fire blight is one I'm thinking about, which infects apples. And there's a variety of other, I think, xanthomonas and fungi. So you may have heard of wheat rust, wheat stem rust, which I think wheat feeds about a fifth of the human race. And we do not have that under control as well as we should. So this is a fungus which can decimate wheat crops, and it's spreading and it's difficult to treat. So that's another one. And then we have nematodes, which are little soil worm, small tiny worms, which can carry diseases, and viruses. I'm actually a virologist by education, so that's my forte. And there's plenty of plant viruses which can decimate crops. Some of them just blow around and land on crops and cause damage. Others are carried by insects or other vectors such as nematodes. And they can be very difficult to deal with, just as we have trouble with COVID-19 right now. Farmers can have trouble dealing with viruses contaminating their crops. So those are some of the pathogens. I think someone who is an expert in the field could probably come up with even more, but those are some you would definitely be aware of as a farmer.
Right. You hear sometimes that products in the supermarket are being sold and marketed as natural. There is often this implication that our ancestors didn't have any of the common problems of today. They didn't have to deal with all of these pests and diseases and viruses. And back when it was peasant farming, everything was jolly and good. Is that true? Like, how have we evolved in any way in the way we do farming?
Well, that's a great question too. So I think that's kind of a nostalgic kind of fairy tale. You know, it's a bit of a fantasy where we forget how, or you know, we've lost track of how difficult it was for farmers in the past. So sure, there were diseases that were uncontrolled, and people lost their crops, their livelihoods. There were famines. There were, you know, all kinds of problems, and we just don't necessarily think this way anymore. Largely due, I think, to improvements in agricultural practices and including our use of chemicals and our, in certain cases, even biotechnology, the advent of biotechnology. But I think our yields have increased dramatically just by learning how to farm smarter and to take advantage of all the different types of inputs we have available. Even things like irrigation, you know, which we don't really think about these days, that was a problem in the past. So people wouldn't have continuous access to water for their crops. And now we know how to work to, you know, make sure that's available.
So some consumers would say, like, I remember even my grandmother saying, well, if you have mold on something, you just scrape it off. If there's something ugly on the fruit, you just get rid of it. How does something that affects a plant or anything that is being grown, how does it affect human health? So how can something how can our food make us sick? Is that a common problem? How does it manifest?
Oh, sure. So sure that can. I think, you know, the first things that came to mind when you mentioned that is just you're losing productivity. So you would have, you know, some of your crop is just going to waste. You're not going to be able to eat it. And that's, you know, that's a really terrible shame. And that certainly happened in the past. In other instances, the crop can become toxic, in fact. So I think it's in certain cases, we can talk about BT corn, for example, but some corn that would be infected by insects would become, broken down or deteriorate so much that infections, bacterial infections, can take place, or fungal infections inside of the crop, and these toxins could be produced that can make you very sick and kill you or cause cancers or miscarriages. And that still takes place in parts of Africa. And that's a matter of, these pathogens being able to spread through crops and the people there not having the right tools to have proper storage containers and things like this where they can control spread of these pathogens. So certainly it can infect your health in many ways. Yeah.
So when you mentioned the solutions to some of these problems, when we talk about chemicals, especially here in Europe, people are very anxious of these crop protection tools, pesticides, and you have some of the worst names on the book for, and we even see in France that farmers are being attacked by people just for simply going out on the field and spraying. So simultaneously in the United States and in Canada, there seems to be less hostility towards the agricultural sector. So right now in the European Union, we have something called the Farm to Fork Strategy, which seeks to increase organic farming to up to 25% of all farming in Europe, which is currently around 7% average in most member states, and sometimes less. So why is that? Why are Europeans so watchful and so suspicious, while there seems to be considerably more innovation going on in North America?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think I have pieces of answers. I probably don't have all the answers to that one. I think that part of the answer lies in just the history of the two continents. So North America was, populated later by, and farming was developed a bit differently, I think. Whereas in Europe, I think we have these, very old farms, and it's just, it's just a, it's a different setup. So you just have different, both places come from different histories. I do think as well that, well, another thing to say for what it's worth is, in North America, things can be quite harsh here in terms of the environment. So, we have, you really have to work. I think our pioneers probably had to work very hard to tame the land, so to speak. So we have, in Canada, deep frosts and, very cold weather and, can be very hostile. So people had a different approach. And whereas, in somewhere like Italy, it can be quite pleasant most of the time and just wouldn't encounter the same challenges. So I think that had an effect as well. But mostly I would say right now, I think there's, it's the activists, the ability of activists to get through to Europeans in a manner that maybe they're not as successful as at doing that here in North America. And we had I hear about GMO fields being burned down and things like this in Europe, and I don't think you can I don't think I ever hear of that happening here. So people don't seem to they've grown up with technology. Technology has been developed around them. This is a new country in a matter of speaking. And they just don't seem to hold the same sensibilities about agriculture as the Europeans do. So that's some of it. I think Europe as well, the regulations are different. We have the product and process. I think Europeans are into, I think it's the process where they're very concerned about how the crops were developed, whereas in North America, we're more concerned about the product, what does the product look like, and if it's basically you're getting the same thing, no matter how, what breeding technology you use, it's still basically the same. So those are some things. I've heard from European scientists that Europe in general, it's difficult to make any kind of decision in Europe because there's all these countries who have their different opinions and to get a consensus is next to impossible. So I think that slows things down. And perhaps here in North America, it's just the way our countries are set up. Things can move a little more quickly. That's certainly a thought.
We have something called, in the European Union, we have something called the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle basically applies to the technology itself, which is the reason why most GMOs and gene editing technologies such as CRISPR have actually not been legal in the European Union for food production. So actually, let's get to that topic as well. So what exciting innovations can farming actually still produce? Is because people would look at the farmers like, what could be possibly change or achieve in farming? But like, what amazing technologies are out there to revolutionize the food that we eat, but that some Europeans ought to know about before they become too skeptical about what, become too decisive about what ought to be outlawed, let's say.
Right. Okay. Well, it's a really, broad and enormous question with lots and lots of ways to answer it. But I think, reduced use of pesticides by using genetically modified crops is it's very clear. In fact, I have a few papers here. This is one from Matim Keim. I don't know if you guys would have heard of this, but he's from University of Göttingen. You can pronounce it for me. I'm sorry if that's how you say it
I'm
in Germany.
Sure.
You're not sure.
Göttingen. Oh yes, so, exactly. Yes.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
But he has a table here. So there's just, you know, enormous amounts of scientific literature showing how genetically modified crops have helped farmers and helped the world. So here in his table, he talks about the yield is in general 22% increased for all for GM crops versus conventional crops. Pesticide use is down 37% in general. So you're reducing the use of pesticides, which is important. Profits for farms is up by 68%. So these are like really, you know, significant important numbers for people to be aware of. And there's just tons of literature of this sort of nature, where collections of studies after studies. But those are kind of the main, you know, I think, you know, we were talking about pests and pesticides and things like this. There are so many other uses for genetically modified crops or genome edited crops. For example, we can decrease the use or the need for fertilizers. We can make crops more nitrogen efficient. We can make them more climate smart, so they would be able to be resilient to big temperature changes, or very hot or very low temperature, or flooding. Salt tolerance. All of these are going on right now. They have nothing to do with synthetic chemical inputs. They have to do with just making the crop be better suited for a changing climate, which is what we have right now. I'm very interested in nutritional content of crops. So we have nutritionally enhanced crops, for example, crops that express omega-3s, which are oils that are found in seafood. So we don't have enough of these oils available for the human race right now, but we could make them in crops. So, you know, how great is that? We can really save some people. We have, iron and zinc fortified crops that people can grow themselves, and they don't need to be handed supplements. And that could be very useful for people who are in developing countries and just don't have access or have disrupted access. So certainly right now with COVID-19 disrupting our food supplies and what have you, you know, people are losing access to their regular, regular international trade. So if they had their own crops, this would be great for them. Other uses are bioremediation. So if you polluted areas, we can design crops that will get rid of the pollution, which I think would be really wonderful. And those are a few. Genome editing is the next step, and it's such a shame, it's such a terrible shame that Europeans have not fought to have this technology accepted, because it really involves just making a change or two, a nucleotide change or two to a crop, and making it very feasible for a university or, you know, a small group of people to develop a crop that could be quickly available to everyone. And I just think that's certainly the way to go, and it's very exciting from my perspective. And I hope that Europeans change their mind. There is some hope, though. I had another paper I was reading about, and this is someone from Romania recently, who just wrote about more favorable attitudes of Europeans about GMOs. And they're talking here specifically about something called cisgenics. So cisgenics is when you have a gene from a crop that has that you can transfer to the same sort of crop. So for example, you might have a tomato, one variety of tomato, and you'd like the gene from that tomato to be in another variety of tomato. So they're both tomatoes, and one variety lost that gene and the other one has it. Or you could have a wild type crop that has a resistance gene, but it was lost over domestication and it's no longer there. So wouldn't it be great to go back and take the wild type crop, the one that's grown in the wild, and find that gene and put it back So we lost it ourselves over, you know, millennia of growing and crop breeding, but we could return it. And so we really not, you know, it's not quite the same as a GMO. And somehow it seems that according to this, that Europeans are more in favor of that sort of thing. So that kind of, you know, that's a use of the technology, and, you know, it could really make a difference for Europeans, I think. My big concern about farm to fork policy is that I don't see how the numbers work. Usually when we think about organic farming, we often think that the yield is lower, you know, if faced with different stresses, and for sure we will be faced with stresses with climate change. It's more difficult for Europeans to get the same sorts of yields. So if they can't increase their yields and they're not using synthetic chemicals, though organic farming does use some, you know, chemical inputs. So it's very confusing for, you know, I have a lot of trouble understanding what the shtick is here. Where will they get their food? Because they won't be able to make enough. They really need to double their productivity for the next, you know, I'd say within the next 50 years. And if they're not doing that in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if they can't do it.
You're not the only scientist who actually brought this up. So this brings me to another point. And I think that is something we've experienced in Europe, is that when scientists have brought this up and when the European Food Safety Authority has said certain chemicals are safe, in the political process, what we've seen is that we've started doubting the scientists and the integrity of the scientific process that was behind it. Do you feel this as well in your work? Do you think this becomes an increasing problem? And maybe if you have an example, I'm pretty sure that your expertise, vaccines in plants, I mean, I can already imagine what people might accuse you of doing, tampering with our food. Can you talk to that a bit?
Well, that's a great one too. So certainly, you know, hanging around with people at the university, that doesn't happen too much where I'm questioned in that manner. But, you know, I think we met on Twitter, and that is a place where certainly I'm kind of out there trying to defend science. I think that's why I've come out there. And yes, people question all the time. It's a worry that the world is kind of succumbing to conspiracy theories, and I think this is kind of the same. You know, it's part and parcel, or this has been going on for a long time, perhaps, there's either the concern that somehow I'm linked to, you know, Big Ag, whatever that might mean, some large multinational, which I can get kind of furious at this, because, you know, we're just publicly funded scientists, so no, that's not true. Or there's something about, you know, some Bill Gates something or other. I always have trouble with this one too. Sure, I do get attacked, and it's as if there's some ulterior motive, and the motive is that somehow there's a payment that I'm getting, or there's some kind of, you know, something from large industry. And no, this is just, you know, it's not true. I've learned to let it roll off my back. I think it's better to still, you know, try to comment and not get to let your feathers get too ruffled about these kind of things. And I think at the same time, people are listening, you know, although some are attacking, it's probably just a noisy few. And there's a lot of other people who are listening, and they're getting what I'm saying. You know, I think that's true as well. So if I'm able to sway a few people or make them think differently or have a little bit more knowledge, then that's great. You know, that's all I can expect. And some people, I think you can't really change them. Some people have had bad experiences. I can see that when I look around. There's, you know, people who've had cancer and they don't know who to blame, or they're looking for someone to blame, or they're angry at the healthcare system of the country they're in. And that's, You know, those are extra complications that can you know, lead one to, you know, be suspicious of I guess science, but we still have to persevere and you know, try to move forward and try to keep people informed and, you know, not let them phase you.
a very Canadian approach, optimistic and understanding. I can see that definitely has that influence. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of this segment. Okay. Kathleen, where can people find you and your work?
Oh, thanks. So yes, I'm at Cornell in the Department of Microbiology. You can look me up there. If you go to, you know, I think you can Google me or go to PubMed and you'll find some of my papers and learn about some of the work I've been doing, I've done in the past. I think, you know, that's great as well. And, you know, that's it. I don't really have a web page at the moment, but maybe I should make one.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Kathleen Heffron, PhD, on Twitter at @kheffron. And also, of course, follow the Consumer Choice Center at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have to learn.